to your intention. Again, don't be too tough on yourself when this happens. This is the way your brain is wired to work. If you feel like going for longer when your timer rings, which you probably will because you'll be on a roll, don't stop. That covers the how. Here are a few suggestions that I have found work for deciding when you should hyperfocus. Whenever you can. Naturally, we need time for the little things, but the more you can hyperfocus, the better. Throughout the week, you should schedule as many blocks of time to hyperfocus as your work will allow, and for as long as you personally feel comfortable. We're the most productive and happy when we work on one meaningful thing at a time, so there's no reason not to spend as much time in this mode as we possibly can. Whenever you have an important task or project and a window in which you can work on it, don't pass up the opportunity to hyperfocus. You'll be missing out on a lot of productivity if you do. Naturally, because of the nature of our jobs, we often have to do a lot of collaborative work, which necessitates our being available to our colleagues. But when you're working on a task that only you can do, it's the perfect time to enter into hyperfocus mode. Around the constraints of your work. Most of us don't have the luxury of hyperfocusing whenever we wish. Productivity is often a process of understanding our constraints. On most days, we will be able to find a few opportunities to hyperfocus, and on others, it simply won't be possible. I find the latter to be especially the case when traveling, when I'm at a conference, or when I have a full day of exhausting meetings. Make sure you account for time and energy constraints, and if possible, work around these obstacles when you're planning your week. When you need to work on a complex task. While I started hyperfocusing by scheduling blocks of time into my calendar, I now enter into the mode whenever I'm working on a complex task or project that will benefit from my complete attention. If I'm just checking my email, I won't set an intention to hyperfocus, but if I'm writing, planning a talk, or attending an important meeting, I invariably do. Based on how averse you are to what you intend to accomplish. The more aversive you find a task or project, the more important it is to tame distractions ahead of time. You're most likely to procrastinate on tasks that you consider boring, frustrating, difficult, ambiguous, or unstructured, or that you don't find rewarding or meaningful. In fact, if you call to mind something you're putting off doing, chances are it has most of these characteristics. The more aversive a task, the more important it is that we enter into a hyper-focused state, so we can work on the task with intention. Building your focus. Over the next several chapters, I'll give you the tools you need to develop your focus. As you'll find, your ability to hyper-focus depends on a few factors, all of which affect the quality of your attention. How frequently you seek out new and novel objects of attention. How often you habitually overload your attentional space. How frequently your attention is derailed by interruptions and distractions. How many tasks, commitments, ideas, and other unresolved issues you're keeping in your head. How frequently you practice meta-awareness, checking what's already consuming your attention. As we'll discuss, even your mood and diet can influence hyperfocus. For these reasons and more, everyone has a different starting point when it comes to entering the mode. Ironically, when I first started exploring the research on how we best manage our attention, I could hardly focus for more than a few minutes before becoming distracted. This is often the case when we continually seek novel objects of attention and work in a distracting environment. While experimenting with the research, I've been able to steadily increase the amount of time I can hyperfocus, and I've grown accustomed to working with fewer distractions. I wrote the sentence you're now listening to near the end of a 45-minute hyperfocus session, my third of the day. These sessions have enabled me to write exactly 2,286 words in around 2 hours. This is one of the fun parts about writing a book about productivity. You can verify that your methods actually work by using them to write the book itself. The third session was my last hyperfocus block, and between those periods, I caught up on email, enjoyed checking social media, and had a quick chat with a coworker or two. But right now isn't one of those times. And focusing on just one thing, writing these words, is what has allowed me to be so productive over the last 45 minutes. It'll work for you too. Chapter 4. Taming Distractions. 40 seconds. Two fascinating experts I had the chance to speak with while writing this book were Gloria Mark and Mary Cherwinski. Mark is a professor of information science at the University of California at Irvine and is perhaps the world's foremost expert on attention and multitasking. She has conducted attentional studies in partnership with NASA and with companies like Boeing, Intel, IBM, and Microsoft. Cherwinski, a principal researcher at Microsoft, is one of the leading experts on how people and computers interact. Microsoft does a surprising amount of research at this, writing it employs over 2,000 people who do and publish research full-time. Her work, and my conversations with her, color most of this chapter. The two scientists have teamed up to conduct scores of studies into our relationship with technology on a daily basis. What I love the most about their work is that they specialize in what is called in situ research, conducting studies in actual workplaces on real workers, to measure how stressed participants felt after multitasking or doing email. Mark and Cherwinski strapped monitors to them to wear for 24 hours a day to chart their heart rate variability, a scientifically validated measure of stress. With their permission, Mark and Cherwinski installed the logging program on participants' computers to observe exactly how often they switched between tasks, every 40 seconds. Shockingly, we interrupt ourselves even more often when we keep apps like IM and Skype open, every 35 seconds. Their work is worth calling out for a number of reasons. First, in situ research is much more difficult to conduct. It took Mark 6 years to find an organization that would let her study employees when they went without email for a week, for example. But the approach is particularly worthwhile. As she explained to me, quote, "As opposed to taking someone into a laboratory and setting up artificial conditions to simulate the world, you're going into the world and observing things as they actually are," end quote. Second, their research is worth examining because it's groundbreaking. By far, my favorite of the studies they conducted was the 40-second task switching study I just mentioned. So often, we go from being totally productive and immersed in our work to interrupting ourselves to do something unrelated and far less important. We interrupt a meaningful conversation with a friend to check our phone. We set aside writing a report to initiate a pointless IM chat. We go from building an Excel worksheet to visit with an office colleague for no good reason. Another study they conducted found that we switch between computer applications 566 times during the average workday. This figure includes distractions that have nothing to do with our work itself. We check Facebook, for example, an average of 21 times every day. This average includes every subject in the study, some of whom didn't look at Facebook at all. When you calculate the average among people who visited Facebook at least once, it doubles to 38 daily checks. Our work obviously suffers from these distractions, and we fail to enter into a hyper-focused state. We compensate by working faster and more frantically, which affects the quality of what we produce and stresses us out. And perhaps most important, we fail to take control of and deliberately manage our attention. Interruptions that are in some way related to a project we're working on don't derail our productivity as severely. If someone sends us a message with information relevant to a report we're preparing, for example, we can refocus with relative ease. But we rarely have just one project on our plate. On average, we're juggling about 10 simultaneously. Your email and message notifications may be worth keeping on if you and your team are collaborating on the same project in crunch mode. But under most circumstances, this isn't the case. The cost of an unrelated interruption can be massive. It takes an average of 25 minutes to resume working on an activity after we're interrupted. And before resuming that activity, we work on an average of 2.26 other tasks. We don't simply attend to the distraction or interruption and then return to the original task. We become distracted a second time before doing so. Distractions can become even costlier after the age of 40. Your attentional space shrinks as you age, which makes it more difficult to get back on track. Once you become aware of how frequently you interrupt yourself, it's hard to go back to working the same way again. This is why it is so critical to manage your attention wisely. You can focus for so much longer by taming distractions ahead of time. A footnote on this, one question that comes up frequently in attentional research is how women and men differ when it comes to multitasking. Women experience fewer interruptions and interrupt themselves less overall, and they do so while working on more projects at once. Compared with men, women are also happier and more engaged in the workplace. Why we love distractions. There is a simple reason why we fall victim to distractions. Even though we know they're unproductive, in the moment, they are much more enticing than our work. When our brain is even slightly resisting a task, it hunts for more attractive things it could do instead. Let your mind be for a few seconds, and you'll find that it gravitates to more captivating and usually less important objects of attention than what you should be focusing on. We can't even go to the bathroom anymore without mindlessly distracting ourselves. I'd genuinely love to see how the duration of our bathroom breaks has changed over time. I'd wager a guess that they've at least doubled now that we carry around smartphones. Something that's gone down since the introduction of the smartphone? Chewing gum sales. Since 2007, the year the iPhone was introduced, gum sales have plummeted 17%. Obviously, correlation doesn't imply causation, but it does make you wonder. Our drive toward distractions is made worse by our brain's built-in novelty bias and the fact that websites and apps we frequent offer a hit of mindless stimulation and validation every time we visit them. You probably have a few notifications waiting each time you open Twitter. Who shared your last post? New people who have followed you and so on. It's hard to resist the urge to check the site throughout the day, knowing another small hit of validation is just a click away. Even if you have no messages waiting, the possibility that you could have some draws you back. I deleted my Facebook account a few years ago for this very reason. I'm typing these words in one window on my computer screen, but I know that in no time at all, it's possible to open another that could provide hours of distraction. Writing is a difficult task that my brain resists. I love the result, but the process takes a lot more focus and energy than checking social media, answering email, or checking the news. If I don't disable computer distractions ahead of time, I might as well wave goodbye to my productivity. As a small experiment, I didn't block any distractions on my computer this morning. Left to my own devices, I bounced around an endless loop of stimulating websites for 30 minutes. Looking at my browsing history, I had visited Twitter, Reddit, specifically the mechanical keyboard subreddit, several news websites, including Feedly, the New York Times, CNN, The Verge, and MacRumors, my second Twitter account, email, I have three email accounts and checked them each a time or two, and the Amazon page for my first book to check how well it was selling and to see if it had any new customer reviews. It's also worth noting that I checked these websites after meditating for 25 minutes, a ritual that usually enables me to act with more intention. Chances are you have your own list of distracting websites and apps you frequent when you're resisting a task. A footnote on this. Curiously, the distractions you're most likely to fall victim to differ depending on what you're working on. When you're doing rote work, you're significantly more likely to visit Facebook or initiate a face-to-face interaction with a coworker. When you're focused on more complex work, you're more likely to check your email. The anecdote I just mentioned alone should dispel any notion that, as a productivity expert, I have a superhuman level of control. What I am better at is managing my impulses ahead of time. After choosing how long you'll focus, eliminating distractions is the second step of hyperfocus. Eliminating distractions before you hunker down on a task makes focusing infinitely easier, as important tasks fill your attentional space quite naturally when there is nothing competing with them. Given that distractions have the potential to derail our productivity so frequently and for so long, it's imperative that we deal with them ahead of time, before we have to expend precious willpower to resist their allure. The four types of distractions. In Chapter 1, I introduced the four types of work tasks: productive tasks that are either necessary or purposeful, and unproductive tasks that are either unnecessary or distracting. In this section, we'll focus on the distracting tasks that are fun and unproductive. I define a distraction as anything that can direct us away from our intentions. In this respect, distractions and interruptions are much the same thing because they both distance us from what we intend to accomplish. Some interruptions are essential, such as a piece of information you receive that's related to what you're working on in that moment. But most of them are worth taming ahead of time. If we zoom in on the distracting work quadrant back in the first chapter, we can divide it up based on two criteria: whether or not we have control over the distractions, and whether we find them annoying or fun. If you allocated your professional activities into the four types of work grid in Chapter 1, use the tasks in the distracting quadrant as a starting point to fill out a similar 2x2 grid that divides your distractions based on whether or not they're within your control and whether they're annoying or fun. There will be a number of items to add. Your distractions grid should contain every single thing, no matter how small, that draws you away from your intentions in the moment. It should also include distractions that aren't specifically work-related, such as the news and social media websites you visit as you work. I won't ask you to do many exercises as you listen to this audiobook, but when I do include them, it's definitely for a good reason. I've uploaded versions of both charts to this book's website, hyperfocusbook.com. To illustrate what a filled-out grid looks like, here are the typical distractions that throw off my intentions throughout the course of the day that I've filled my own chart out with. Some annoying distractions that I can't control include office visitors, loud colleagues, and meetings. Some fun distractions that I can't control include surprise team lunches, calls from loved ones, and water cooler conversations. Some distractions I can control that are annoying include email, phone alerts, and unnecessary meetings. And finally, some distractions I can control that are fun include news websites, social media accounts, and instant message accounts. Let's start with how to deal with distractions and interruptions that we can't control. There are two places from which distractions originate: ourselves and others, and both are important to deal with ahead of time. We can't prevent all distractions from arising, even if we closed our office door with the intent to hyperfocus for a couple of hours. We'd still receive phone calls and the occasional knock at the door. Many distractions are preventable, but many aren't, at least not without incurring large social costs. Research shows, however, that we interrupt ourselves just as much as we're interrupted by other people. This isn't the case if you're a manager or a team leader, however. In this case, 60% of your interruptions come from others. As Gloria Mark expressed it, simply looking at how we can break off external interruptions really only solves half the problem. Distractions from others aren't quite as damaging as the times we interrupt ourselves. It takes us an average of 29 minutes to resume a task after we have interrupted our own work. However, we get back on track around 6 minutes more quickly if we're interrupted by someone else. Whether it's 29 minutes or 23 minutes, we're still missing out on a lot of productivity. This is one of myriad reasons why periodically checking what's occupying our attentional space is so helpful. When we notice distractions have veered us off course, we waste less time on distracting tasks and get back on track more quickly. While we can't prevent interruptions from arising, we can control how we respond to them. The best way to deal with annoying tasks that we can't keep from hijacking our attentional space, office visitors, loud colleagues, and unnecessary meetings included, is to keep our original intention in mind and get back to working on it as soon as possible. We should also be more deliberate about how we respond to the fun distractions we can't control. Of all the advice I offer in this book, this is the tactic I've struggled with the most. I'm often so gung-ho in accomplishing my intentions that I become rigid and grumpy when I'm interrupted, regardless of how enjoyable the interruption might be. As I've found, though, the best possible way to respond to pleasurable, uncontrollable distractions, like team lunches and calls from loved ones when I'm in the middle of something, is to make a concerted effort to embrace and actually allow myself to enjoy them, but still get back on track when I'm able. Fretting over things you simply can't control is a waste of time, energy, and attention. I've gradually learned to use these interruptions as a cue to lighten up a bit and embrace whatever fun derailed my productivity while periodically recalling my original intention so I can get back on track when I have the opportunity. Distraction-free mode. Most distractions fall into the category of ones we actually can control, which should therefore be tamed in advance. Over time, I've developed two modes of working. One, a distraction-free mode, which I enter whenever I'm about to hyperfocus. And two, a regular, reduced distraction working mode, where I work with a manageable number of distractions throughout the day. Over the course of the day, we alternate between doing two types of work: focus work and collaborative work. The breakdown of how much focus and collaborative work you do varies depending on your job. If you're an administrative assistant, your work may involve 90% collaboration and 10% focus work. If you're a writer, your work may require 90% focus work and 10% collaboration. Ask yourself, roughly what breakdown does your job have overall? Focus work benefits from all the attention we can bring to it. The less we're distracted, the more deeply we're able to focus, and the more productive we become. This allows us, as author Cal Newport has put it, to do deep work. Collaborative work, on the other hand, involves interacting with other people and being available in case you're needed. The more you and your team are available for one another, the more productive your team as a whole becomes. When engaged in collaborative work, it's best to enter into reduced distraction mode, in which you've tamed your largest distractions but are still accessible when you're needed. Let's tackle the more intense distraction-free mode first. Creating a distraction-free mode enables you to eliminate almost every controllable distraction in advance, so you can hyperfocus on your most important tasks. By removing every object of attention that's potentially more stimulating and attractive than what you intend to do, you give your brain no choice but to work on that task. I'm writing these words in my own distraction-free mode. To enter this mode and hyperfocus, I do the following. Launch a distraction-blocking app on my computer, which prevents me from accessing the websites that derail my productivity: email, social media sites, Amazon, and every other app and website I've specified on a block list. I specify the duration of time I want to hyperfocus, and if I do want to access any blocked sites during that period, I have to physically restart my computer. Since most of my work is done on a computer, this is easily the most important measure I take. I also put my computer in Do Not Disturb mode, so I'm not distracted as notifications come in. I also put my phone in Do Not Disturb mode and keep it out of sight or in another room so I'm not tempted to check it. I also grab a coffee If I'm not going to bed in the next 10 hours, again, it takes caffeine an average of 8 to 14 hours to metabolize out of your system. And finally, I put on noise-canceling headphones, so I'm not distracted by sounds in my environment. I don't always use them in my office, or if I'm working out of a hotel room, but I'll do so without fail if I'm hyper-focusing on a plane or at a coffee shop. Which distractions derail your productivity over the course of a day? How many of them can you disable simultaneously with a blocking app or some other tactic? Write a quick plan that will guide you in dealing with these distractions ahead of time. When you find your attention getting derailed, reflect on what caused it so you can disable that distraction the next time around. For example, when I'm distracted by a new website or app while in distraction-free mode, I'll immediately add that site to my block list. Here are a few more suggestions for creating your distraction-free mode. There are many apps available that cut you off from distractions. A few of my favorites for computer are Freedom, paid, though there's a free trial for Windows, Mac, the iPhone, and the iPad. Cold Turkey, it's free, though there's a paid version for Windows, Mac, and Android. And Rescue Time, it's paid, though there's a free trial for PC, Mac, Android, and Linux. Most of these cost a few dollars a month for the pro version, but you'll earn that money back in increased productivity. The research backs this up. People who deploy distraction blockers are more productive and focused for longer periods of time. Side note, we're only beginning to understand how traits such as conscientiousness, neuroticism, and impulsiveness work together to determine how distractible we are. These traits also determine how much stress the use of distraction blockers may cause. If you find you become anxious with a distraction blocker enabled, you may decide that you want to resort to using it only when you're working on a task that's especially onerous, or when you have less energy and therefore less of an ability to resist distractions. If your workplace restricts what apps or plugins you can install on your computer, consider either unplugging the Ethernet cable or completely shutting off your computer's Wi-Fi. This sounds extreme, but we spend a lot of our internet time procrastinating. Get out of the office. If you work in a more flexible office environment, you might find a distraction-free mode can incorporate working out of the coffee shop downstairs or in a meeting room. Be thoughtful, and don't underestimate or overestimate the social costs of your distraction-free mode. Consider the effects of shutting yourself off from your coworkers, especially if your workplace is a social environment. At the same time, don't overestimate the social costs. While you might feel guilty closing your email client for 30 minutes, remember that your clients and coworkers frequently have to wait an hour or two for you to respond when you're caught in meetings. This is a lesson I'm relearning constantly. As a general rule, your coworkers need you a lot less than you think they do. Treat yourself. After I've completed a hyper-focus session and I leave my distraction-free mode, I'll occasionally treat myself to an all-you-can-eat buffet of distractions. Research shows that the more impulsive you are, the more stressed you become by blocking yourself from distractions. If you do have little self-control, or if you're impulsive, indulging in the odd distraction break can be beneficial. Side note, impulsiveness is also the character trait most highly correlated with procrastination. I'll also usually indulge a cup of matcha or coffee before entering back into my distraction-free mode, which positively reinforces my behavior to focus more deeply. Create a distraction-free mode for your team. Dale Partridge, author of People Over Profit, went as far as to equip his team with lamps and squirt guns to encourage them to focus when he was CEO of Sevenly. As he explained to me, quote, "One of the smartest things I did at Sevenly was to build custom walnut desk lamps for the entire team. They turned them on whenever they wanted to focus, and the rule was that no one was allowed to interrupt them when their lamp was on. All 45 employees were allowed to have up to 3 hours of uninterrupted focus time per day. We had to limit it because that uninterrupted time was so addictive. I also equipped everyone with a squirt gun so they could spray each other when they were interrupted." End quote. The intensity of your distraction-free mode depends on your work environment. If you work for yourself or have an office with a door, you likely have more flexibility in eliminating distractions. If you work in a collaborative, open office environment, however, you may not be able to set up as strong a distraction-free mode as you'd like. Productivity is a process of understanding and adapting to your constraints. I always experience an odd and wonderful sense of relief when I enter my distraction-free mode, and I think you will too. Suddenly, you don't have to tend to the news, your social media feeds, and a never-ending stream of email. You can relax, confident that you no longer waste time and attention on mindless busy work. You accomplish meaningful work and hyper-focus for a longer period of time. And you know that because you're investing your time, attention, and energy into just one task, you can slow down and work more purposefully. A distraction-free mode also allows you to conserve energy. When you eliminate distractions, your energy goes further, and you can work for longer periods of time without needing a break. By disabling distractions ahead of time, you expend significantly less mental energy regulating your behavior in order to focus on your work. In turn, the less we have to regulate our behavior when we don't have to battle distractions or watch what we say as we deal with a difficult coworker, the more energy our work provides. Breaks are energizing for this same reason. They're a pocket of time in which we can press pause on regulating our behavior. You may find that even though you intended to hyperfocus for only a short amount of time, you have the energy to keep going long after. A distraction-free mode is especially valuable after vacation or long weekend, as during these periods, you'll have less energy and be more susceptible to distraction. Taming the distractions in your work ahead of time enables you to build up your energy as you settle back into your regular working rhythm. Working with reduced distractions. Because it's impossible to work in hyperfocus mode 100% of the time, we should also learn to enjoy the benefits of cutting back on distractions during other periods of our day. To figure out which ones are worth taming, ask yourself, what distractions interrupt your focus throughout the day that aren't worth losing 20 or more minutes of productivity over? It isn't possible to shut off these distractions entirely, and you might not even want to, but it is worth becoming more thoughtful about what interrupts your work. Email is a great example of a distraction that's important to tame but not eliminate. Email is a weird beast. It consumes a lot more attention than it does time. Meetings are the opposite, generally consuming more time than attention. Eliminating email would obviously not be realistic, but try to become more deliberate about when you check for messages. Doing so will allow you to regain control over your attention. Whenever you have email notifications enabled, you permit your coworkers to interrupt your focus on a whim. The instant you receive an email notification, you've lost control. Choosing when you check for messages ahead of time means you maintain control over your attention and resist slipping into autopilot mode. Setting a specific time to focus on distractions like email, meetings, your smartphone, and social media transforms them from distractions into merely other purposeful elements of your work and life. Technology should exist for our convenience, not the convenience of anyone who wants to interrupt us. Countless things clamor for our attention over the course of the day. In this section, I've chosen 5 of the most common pain points: a constant flood of notifications, smartphones and other distracting devices, email, meetings, and finally, the internet. Notifications. An activity I recommended earlier was to scroll through the notification settings on all of your devices and disable audible and vibrating alerts for interruptions you can safely live without. Leaving default settings turned on will flood you with a constant stream of interruptions. It's also worth limiting certain apps to interrupting you on only one device, There's no reason for your phone, tablet, watch, and computer to all inform you that you've just received an email notifying you that your favorite clothing store is having a sale. Disabling most audible and vibrating alerts is a simple change, but one that's totally profound in practice. You suddenly get to choose when you're interrupted by your phone, rather than your phone deciding when to interrupt you. I personally just scan for new text messages and notifications when I check the clock on my phone. Every notification pulls you away from what you're doing and reminds you that there's an entire digital world you're missing out on. Notifications are deceiving, for while it takes just a second to glance at one, that moment can suck you into a digital vortex in which you easily lose a half hour of your time and attention. Not all notifications are worth this productivity drain. That said, many notifications are worth receiving 100% of the time. Phone calls, for example. When I check my email just once a day, as I'll discuss in a bit, I'll often turn on notifications for just one sender if I'm waiting for an important message. Doing this takes a minute or two, but I easily earn that time back in how much more deeply I'm able to focus. This lets me stop worrying and compulsively checking my inbox every few minutes. Setting up your email to receive notifications only for a group of VIP senders is also possible in most email applications and lets you decide who can interrupt you throughout the day. As well as dealing with individual notifications, it's also possible to block when you allow apps to distract you. One of my favorite daily rituals is to put my smartphone and other devices in airplane mode between 8 p.m. and 8 a.m. This is when I have the least energy and am more likely to fall victim to distractions. Plus, research shows we're less likely to multitask when we end our daily activities and go to bed early the night before. If enabling airplane mode feels too drastic, consider enabling your phone's do not disturb mode while you work. Your smartphone and other devices. Apart from managing the notifications that your devices pop up, it's worth becoming deliberate about when, where, and how often you use those devices. Your phone is probably your most stimulating and novel object of attention, and you're absolutely going to be tempted by it, especially when the task you're working on becomes more intimidating or complex. Over time, I've changed my relationship with my phone. Instead of seeing it as a device that should stay attached to my hip for the entire day, I've started to regard it as a powerful, more annoying computer. Their cellular radios aside, our phones have the same parts as a computer. But for some reason, perhaps because they provide us with so much stimulation and validation throughout the day, we allow them to interrupt us constantly, infinitely more than our computers. We shouldn't give any shiny rectangular device so much power. Once I began viewing my smartphone as just a more distracting computer, I kept it stowed in my laptop bag instead of my pocket. And, most important, I made sure I had a good reason before checking it. This shift in attitude has enabled me to use my phone with intention rather than on autopilot mode. Every time you pick up your phone without intent, you derail your attention for no good reason. Here are a few more strategies to prevent your phone and other devices from taking over your life. Mind the gaps. Resist the urge to tap around on your smartphone when you're waiting in line at the grocery store, walking to the coffee shop, or in the bathroom. Use these small breaks to reflect on what you're doing, to recharge, and to consider alternate approaches to your work and life. In these moments, mindlessly burning time on the phone isn't worth it. Doing so eliminates the valuable space in your schedule. Do a phone swap. Swap phones with a good friend or significant other when you're at dinner or hanging out. That way, if you have to look something up, make a call, or take a picture, you'll have a device to do it with, but one that won't suck you into a personalized world of distraction. Strategically use airplane mode. Flip your phone into airplane mode when working on an important task or having coffee with someone. It's impossible to share quality time without also sharing quality attention. Enabling airplane mode makes a bigger difference than merely putting your phone in your pocket, as in the latter case, you're still aware that notifications and distractions are piling up and waiting for you. Airplane mode completely eliminates the possibility that a notification will disrupt your work. You can then deal with those alerts on your own terms later. Buy a second distractions device. This may sound a bit silly, but I recently bought an iPad that I use for one sole purpose, as a distractions device. I keep few social media apps and no email app on my phone and instead use my iPad for all things distracting. Delegating those tasks to the iPad, which I leave in another room, lets me focus for longer and more deeply in the event I do need to keep my smartphone by my side. Buying a tablet for this sole purpose is a sizable investment at first, but your attention is worth it. Create a mindless folder. Try housing your most distracting apps, the ones that pull you into autopilot mode, in a mindless folder on your phone or tablet. The folder's name will serve as an additional reminder that you're about to distract yourself. Prune your list of apps. Scroll through your phone and delete the apps on which you waste too much time and attention, social media and news apps included. Doing so can feel oddly refreshing, a sort of spring cleaning for your phone. Consider which apps duplicate functionality with those on your other devices. Your email app may not be worth keeping if you also access email on your tablet. An investment app you check compulsively might be worth deleting if you can access the same information on your laptop. In the last 30 years, more and more devices have crept into our lives. For me, the process started with my first laptop well over a decade ago. Later, I bought a dumb feature phone and then an even more distracting smartphone. Next came an iPad and a fitness tracker. I'm sure there will be more devices in my future. This speaks to a trap we increasingly face, bringing new devices into our lives without first questioning their value. Clayton Christensen, a professor at Harvard Business School, developed a useful way of assessing the devices in your life. Question what jobs you hire devices to do for you. Every product we buy should do a job for us. We hire Kleenex to blow our nose, Uber to get from one place to another, OpenTable to book a table at a restaurant, Match.com to find a partner. We hire our phones to do a lot of these jobs, maybe more than any other product we own. We hire them to be an alarm clock, camera, timepiece, GPS navigator, video game console, email and messaging machine, boarding pass, music player, radio, subway pass, datebook, map, and so much more. It's no wonder we spend so much time on them. As we accumulate more devices, their jobs can become redundant. The only reason I have a tablet today is because I hire it as my distractions device. If I didn't need that particular service, it's likely I would have hired the tablet to do the exact same job done by my phone and computer, helping me surf the web and using social media, and it would have been totally unnecessary. I recently got rid of my fitness tracker for this very reason. While it was a lot of fun at first, I couldn't remember what job I'd hired it to do. Several years back, I got rid of my TV and cable subscription for a similar reason. Netflix became my hire of choice for passive entertainment. Before you buy another device, ask yourself, what jobs am I hiring it to do that the devices I already own can't? Thinking about your devices this way forces you to consider why you really own them and, perhaps even more important, enables you to bring devices into your life only with intention. Email. In the knowledge economy, Email is one of the largest distractions we face every day. It's usually the largest pain point for the people I speak to and coach, with meetings being a close second. One of the best strategies to tame email is to limit how many email notifications you receive, which limits how frequently you're interrupted. 64% of people use notifications with either audible or visual signals to alert them to new messages. If you fall into this category, you're probably spending too much time and attention on email. In addition to limiting new message alerts, here are 10 of my favorite email tactics. These will help you check your email more deliberately and constrain how much time and attention you spend on it in the first place. Many of these strategies also work with other messaging apps, such as Slack. Check for new messages only if you have the time, attention, and energy to deal with whatever might have come in. This is a simple trigger that lets you make sure you can actually deal with new messages instead of getting stressed by the new stuff to which you have to respond. Keep a tally of how often you check for messages. The average knowledge worker checks his email 11 times per hour, 88 times over the span of a day. It's hard to get any real work done with so many interruptions. The same study found that employees spend an average of just around 35 minutes on email per day, which means that email consumes much more attention than it does actual time. Once you become aware of how often you check for new messages, you'll likely want to reduce that amount of time because of the high cost of interruptions. Pre-decide when you'll check. Determining ahead of time when you'll check for new messages works wonders for reducing the number of times you open your email. 70% of emails are opened within the first 6 seconds of receipt, so shutting off notifications will help you work in a less agitated and reflexive way. I personally check for new messages once a day at 3 p.m. and have an auto-response that notifies people of this. If this frequency is unrealistic for your work, come up with a compatible number. As long as it's less than 88 times over the span of a workday, you'll be doing better than average. It helps to schedule these blocks of time on your calendar and set an auto-response, both to make you feel more comfortable and to hold you socially accountable. If you still find email too tempting, enable a distractions blocker to cut yourself off. 84% of workers keep their email client open in the background as they work, but closing it will help you focus beyond the 40-second mark. Hyperfocus on email. If you work in an environment that demands that you be highly responsive to emails, try hyperfocusing while answering your messages. Set a timer for 20 minutes and in that time, blow through as many emails as you possibly can. Even if you receive an extraordinary number of messages, hyperfocusing on your inbox for 20 minutes, even as often as at the top of each hour, will enable you to get back to people quickly and allow you to still accomplish meaningful work the rest of the time. Plus, at most, the senders will have to wait only 40 to 60 minutes for a response. Limit points of contact. It takes only 10 seconds to carry out one of the most important productivity tactics, deleting the email app off your phone. I have an email app only on my distractions device and on my computer. Keep an external to-do list. Your email application is the worst possible place to keep a to-do list. It's distracting and overwhelming, and new stuff is constantly popping up, which makes it difficult to prioritize tasks and tell what's truly important. A task list, where you simply keep a tally of what you have to get done today, preferably with your three daily intentions at the top, is simpler and much more powerful. While it takes an extra step to move your actionable emails to a separate list, doing so will leave you feeling much less overwhelmed and will enable you to better organize what's on your plate. Sign up for two email accounts. I have two email addresses, one that's public-facing and a private one for my closest colleagues. While I check my public-facing account once a day, I batch-check the other inbox a few times throughout the day. In select cases, this is a strategy worth adopting. Take an email holiday. If you're hunkering down on a big project, set up an autoresponder explaining that you're on a 1 or 2 day email holiday and that you're still in the office and can be reached by phone or in person for urgent requests. People are far more understanding of this strategy than you may think. Use the 5-sentence rule. In order to save your time and respect your email recipient's time, keep each message you write to 5 sentences or less and add a note to your email signature explaining that you're doing so. If you feel the urge to write anything longer, use that as an opportunity to pick up the phone. This may save you from engaging in an unnecessarily protracted email exchange. Wait before sending important messages. Not every email is worth sending immediately. This is particularly true when you find yourself in an emotionally charged state while drafting a reply. Some responses you might ultimately decide aren't worth sending at all. For important messages, heated exchanges, or emails that require more thought, give yourself time to respond and let your mind wander to let new, better, and more creative ideas rise to the surface. However we deal with it, email remains one of the most stressful elements of our work. One study that had asked participants to go without email observed that after a period of just 1 week, their heart rate variability changed as they became significantly less stressed. The subjects interacted more often with people, spent longer working on tasks, multitasked less, and became much more focused. The absence of email allowed people to work slowly and more deliberately. When the experiment ended, participants described the experience as liberating, peaceful, and refreshing. While it would be impossible to get rid of email completely, try the tactics I just mentioned and experiment with what works best for you. Meetings. After email, meetings are one of the biggest distractions we face throughout the day. They also consume an inordinate amount of time. A recent study found that, on average, knowledge workers spend 37% of their time in meetings, which means that if you work an 8-hour day, you typically spend 3 hours daily in meetings. Meetings are remarkably costly. Gather even a small group of people in a conference room for an hour, and you can easily lose an entire day's worth of work. That's not counting the time it takes everyone to switch his or her attention to and from what's being discussed. There is nothing inherently wrong with such gatherings, but pointless meetings are one of the largest productivity drains in the modern office. Here are 4 of my favorite ways to reel in the number of meetings you attend and make the ones you do take part in more productive. Never attend a meeting without an agenda. Ever. A meeting without an agenda is a meeting without a purpose. Whenever I'm invited to a meeting without an agenda, regardless of whom it's with, I'll ask for the objective. Very frequently, whoever scheduled it will find that the purpose can be accomplished with a couple of emails or a phone call. Push back on any meeting without an agenda. Your time is too valuable. Question every recurring meeting on your calendar. We often fail to question the value of routine meetings. Sift through the next month or two on your calendar and consider which recurring meetings are truly worth your time and attention. Some may be more valuable than they seem on the surface, especially when they enable you to connect and learn more about what your team is doing, but just as many aren't. Some may be difficult to get out of, but taking a few minutes to gracefully ease your way out will save hours later on. Challenge the attendance list. Does everybody invited need to be there? The answer is usually no. If you're a manager or a team leader or just want to save someone time, let certain participants whose presence isn't critical know that while they're definitely welcome, their attendance is optional if they have something else important to work on. Hyperfocus on meetings. Engaging can be tough when meetings consume more of your time than they do attention and energy. But if you do decide a meeting is worth attending, or you can't get out of it, enjoy it. Leave your phone or your computer behind and focus on what everyone is saying. Contribute what you can, and whenever you can, help move things along so that everyone can leave early. You may end up getting a lot of value out of the meeting after all. Some of the best productivity strategies you'll adopt will seem obvious in hindsight, and I'd include these suggestions in that category. Each of them is a matter of common sense. However, the great benefit of any productivity book, though granted I'm a bit biased, is that it allows you to step back from your work to notice what you could be doing differently. As the saying goes, common sense isn't always common action. The internet. Quite a few of the distractions I've discussed in this section have something in common. They stem from the internet. As powerful a tool as the internet is, it distracts and interrupts us and can lead us to spend a lot of time on autopilot mode. Just as our mind wanders while we work, we often surf the internet in active daydreaming mode, switching among websites and apps without intention. While reducing distractions and creating a distraction-free mode will go a long way toward helping you work with more intention, it's often worth taking this even a step further and disconnecting from the internet entirely. This can be beneficial not only at work. Being disconnected from the internet for a 12-hour period at home is nothing short of refreshing. When you're traveling, you'll never be so productive and invigorated as after you decide not to buy access to the internet on a bus or a plane. You'll spend about half of your online time procrastinating. The benefits of being connected often simply aren't worth how much longer everything takes. Don't just take my word for it. Try disconnecting completely for a period of 24 hours this Sunday and encourage your family to do the same. Instead of ponying up for internet access on the plane the next time you travel, work on an offline project that is important but not urgent. Reflect afterward. How restored do you feel? How much were you able to accomplish? If you're anything like me, you'll probably be motivated to limit your access to the internet in the future, too. Simplifying your environment. Several years ago, I worked in the recruitment department of a large company. One of my coworkers, Penny, kept a small bowl of jelly beans on her desk. This, in and of itself, wasn't remarkable. But what I did find remarkable was the fact that she ate almost none of them. It's not that she didn't like jelly beans, she just wasn't tempted that much by food. Every day she'd nibble at a few, leaving the rest for anyone who happened to stop by. I probably ate 90% of those jelly beans. Every time I walked by Penny's office, I'd grab a small handful of candy, an amount that was always, at least in my eyes, asymptotically close to the socially acceptable limit. If I had a similar bowl in my office, I don't think it would have lasted the afternoon. This past Friday, my fiancé and I hosted a party, and we had two large bags of chips left over. I ate both within 2 days. My friends are often surprised when I share stories like this. As someone who researches and experiments with productivity as a full-time job, I'm pretty sure some of them expect me to have a superhuman level of self-control. But much as I do to resist digital distractions when writing, I try to deal with other temptations in my life ahead of time. Because food is my biggest weakness, I modify my external environment to avoid keeping any unhealthy snacks in the house, and if they are around, I ask someone to hide them. Whether with food or distractions, we're highly influenced by our external environment. Takeout menus stuck on your refrigerator are a reminder that tasty, unhealthy food is only a call away, just as keeping cut-up vegetables and hummus in the fridge will remind